Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparutate sangamatasa dwara yeso tvanto pumunchantu sadhanti. So the talk for this evening is going to be on loving kindness, mindfulness, and aliens. Right? I ask people, you know, can someone suggest a topic for a talk tonight? And they go, oh, mindfulness in daily life or dealing with anger. And I'm like, oh, that's so boring. I mean, how many talks I've given on those topics in my life? So, I give a talk about aliens. It's much more fun. See, because like when we just did the loving kindness meditation, right? We're just doing for all beings. Right, so what does all beings mean, for a start? Okay, it's something we say in Buddhism very much. Right, it's actually a remarkable feature of Buddhism, and it's one which we find this idea of universal loving kindness, like really universal loving kindness, we find so pervasive through all the Buddha's teachings. This phrase "sabbe satta" in Pali. You know, we become used to it. If you hang around Buddhist circles for a while, you know, may all beings be happy and so on. And we sort of forget what a powerful and what a revolutionary idea this is. You remember, in the Buddha's day, you know, still most people are thinking at the family level or a tribal level. Right? I mean, even today, that's how it is, isn't it, for most people? That's when you think, oh, who do I love or who do I care for? That's what people think about, their families, or, you know, maybe they think, oh, their country or something like that. Or maybe, you know, if they're really big-hearted, they might think about humanity, right? But how many people really just say, all beings, right? May all beings be happy. And not just beings on this planet, but what about other planets all through the universe? So this is not something which is a kind of a minor point. It's not something which is just sort of occasionally inferred from somewhere in Buddhism. It's a basic principle of Buddhism that our sphere of concern, our love, our moral concern, our respect is for all beings, wherever they are, right? Here, humans, animals, yeah, invisible beings, beings on this planet, other worlds, and so on. And so from a Buddhist perspective, or indeed from a perspective of ancient India in general, there's like many world systems. Right? I don't know if you've ever had a look at the Indian cosmologies, but they're quite fascinating because they take it for granted that there are countless world systems. You have the phrases in the Pali Canon, it says, Dasa Sahasi Loka Dhatu, the 10,000-fold world system, which probably means something like a galaxy or something like that. And so these things were taken more or less for granted in ancient India. And it's also more or less taken for granted that there are other beings living on these other places, right? It's not considered, it wasn't like a radical idea that the Buddha had. It wasn't something that was contested at the time. It seemed to be something that everyone seemed to think was pretty obvious, right? What's special about us, right? Why should our little corner of the universe be the only one that actually has life on it, right? I think it's a ridiculous idea. So there's life everywhere. The universe is huge, and well, we know that life isn't very common, right? I mean, proportionally speaking, we know that space is big and empty, and most worlds are pretty barren. But the probability is, and this is what most scientists say, the probability is very likely, given the size of the universe, that there's sentient life in other planets. Now, let me just say for the record, so I'm not liable to be misinterpreted, I do not think that those beings from other planets are running our current governments. I can understand why you would think that. But so far, I don't think there's any conclusive proof that our politicians have been, in fact, replaced by reptiles from outer space. Plenty of reptiles here on Earth. Okay, so that's number one. I also don't think that it's likely that aliens have actually visited us. That's something which, I mean, it's possible. Yes, is it possible? Yes. Does it seem likely? Not particularly, for all kinds of reasons, which I probably won't go into, but I do think it's likely that there are other beings out there, and maybe we'll come across them one day. You know, if you look in science and speculation and science fiction about this, is one of the questions that people would ask is, well, how do you make that contact? How do you know that another beings exist on another planet? And some people think that, well, they'll not be able to pick up your television broadcasts and things like that, right? It's a bit of a worry, right? But in fact, the TV and radio just dissipates before it gets very far off the planet. It's sort of indistinguishable from the background radiation, so you're not really going to be able to do that. Maybe they'll see if there's like an atomic bomb, right? That's something you might be able to see further away. But in Buddhism, there's actually an answer to that question. And it directly addresses that particular question in the Buddha suttas. And at various important stages of the Buddha's life, it says that his enlightenment, that when he became enlightened, that there was this great, powerful radiance surpassing that of the gods that manifested throughout the universe. And that even those beings living in the deepest black of interstellar space, even they were lit up by that light, and they could see each other in that light for the first time. And they could recognize that those other beings existed and say, oh, I didn't know that you were there. I thought I was all alone here in the middle of space. And now I know that there are other beings here as well. Right? So this is how people will know about that there's humanity here on Earth. Yeah? Because there's a Buddha. Yeah? And they'll see the light of the Buddha through the galaxy. Maybe, maybe not, I don't know. But I thought that what a wonderful idea that was, right? The idea that in the middle of space, not to speak of other worlds, right? This is talking about literally beings in space, right? Just living there. Imagine, it's like a hell realm, isn't it? It's like a cold hell. It's just empty and dark and nothing there. What would it even mean to be reborn in that kind of space? Yeah? Boltzmann brains. Anyone heard of Boltzmann brains? I won't go into it. Anyway, you can Google it afterwards, okay? Boltzmann brains. Brains that spontaneously manifest in the middle of space, okay? So, I find that that's a very kind of beautiful idea, the idea that that kind of awakening of the Buddha is something which draws people together and makes us realize that our commonality, makes us realize that there are other beings there. Because, you know, that's kind of how life feels sometimes, doesn't it, right? It kind of feels a bit like here we are lost in the middle of this cold, black intergalactic space and there's nobody else around. And I can't, I'm just here and I'm alone, yeah? And I think that there's something fundamental in our human experience which is looking for that sense of connection, that feels alone. And I don't know of a more dramatic way of presenting that idea, of just thinking about that. I mean, of course, that's how we are, really. I mean, as a species, literally we are on this rock, hurtling through space, and we are, as far as we know, alone. Maybe, yeah, probably are other beings on other planets. Maybe someday we might get to contact them. Hello, how are you? Are you on Facebook? But for the time being, you know, we're pretty alone. You think about, you know, all of the things that we've known, right, in our lives. You know, you look around you, what can we see? Well, you know, we're here on the surface of the earth, and the things that we actually see and experience in our lives is, you know, it's just around here, right? And it's, you know, a few meters up. you know, down to the surface of the ground and maybe a little bit below. And that's where life happens. Yeah, it's like with, you know, this ball, like a bowling ball, with a thin microscopic layer of slime on the outside. And that's life. Yeah, that's all we are. We're just a microscopic layer of slime on this earth. And it's so thin, and it's so fragile, and it's so alone. So one of the great callings, I think, for spiritual life, and the most important things, is to be able to extend our hearts, extend our love, extend our concern beyond just me, just what I want, beyond my immediate concerns. And so this is something, as I was saying before, that the Buddha just stepped in and just wiped all of these things away. He just, all of those petty likes and dislikes and favoritisms and, you know, all the kind of prejudices we have, you know, all of that alienating. You know, think about that word, alienating. Well, when we call aliens aliens, what are we calling them, right? We're calling them other. We're calling them not us. Right? It's not a very nice word. Of course, aliens don't call themselves aliens, right? They're not alien to themselves. They're boring to themselves, right? They're just ordinary, right? On the alien world, it's just like, oh, it's just an ordinary world, you know. I get up and crawl out of my egg and fly through the stratosphere to work again, and, you know, it's just boring, same old, right? So to them, it's not being alien. If we do find contact with aliens, then, you know, that's going to be, I think that's going to be like not a politically correct word to use, right? You're not going to be able to say alien, right? So from a Buddhist point of view, we just say beings. Right? So that's all right. They're just beings. And so when we think about, you know, beings in other planets and other realms and so on, well, often if you look at how people imagine these things, you usually imagine them in some way that it becomes a foil for your humanity. You define it in some way as other, which gets you to show what your humanity is. A good example is someone like Spock from Star Trek, right? I think that's Spock. It doesn't have any emotions, right? And so that character of Spock is there to sort of illustrate something about how emotions are very central to being a human being, right? Now think about that for a minute from a Buddhist point of view. In Buddhism we say that the human being or any kind of being is made up of or has these five khandhas or five aggregates, right? First is the body, feeling, perception, yeah? Intentions, and consciousness or awareness. Yeah. So Spock doesn't have feelings, except he kind of does, right? I mean, this is one of the things they play with in that story, but this is the idea that, you know, can you imagine what it's like to be sentient and to not have feelings or to not feel in the same way that we do? And that's how you can define somebody as alien. But if you think about it, actually, all beings will ultimately will have these things. I suspect, like I can't really say, but I suspect that we're not going to find any life forms that ultimately don't have these things in some way. For example, if we look around ourselves at the Earth, you know, we of course we have many different, millions of different examples of what beings can be on this Earth, right? In the animal realm, right? There's so many different kinds of animals, and yet when we look at them, they all have bodies of some kind. They all have some kind of feeling, yeah, perception. Right? They're able to recognize things, distinguish food from not food, friend from foe, and so on. This is perception. And intention, right? They can make choices to do this or do that. And they have some kind of awareness. They know what's going on around them. Now, of course, it's a difficult question to say, well, how far down in the tree of life can we chase that before, I mean, does a virus have consciousness? Doesn't seem all that likely, does it? Bacteria? A jellyfish? Does a jellyfish have consciousness? I don't know. Bit of a grey area there. But certainly, you know, in terms of the more developed beings, we can say they have those five khandhas and that sense of consciousness. And pretty certain that if we find any aliens, that they're also going to have those things. And so that provides something like a basis for compassion, a basis for understanding. When we look around the animal realm, right? You know, you can see animals have feelings, right? They suffer. And we automatically have that sense of empathy with them. You know, you see children, right? They just empathize with animals so much. And so we feel that connection. Because we feel there's something similar. We can bridge that gap in the species. Yeah? Whatever beings there are in the galaxy or in the universe, maybe they're going to be there. I think they're going to have those five khandhas. If in the Buddhist scriptures, it usually seems, I don't talk about this in too much detail, but it seems that they assume that the sentient beings, the intelligent beings in other realms, more or less look like humans, right? So, you know, you don't have a sentient blob of slime. But what do you think about that? We meet aliens, are they going to be like us or unlike us? I guess we won't really know until we meet them. But I do think that there's something to that idea in Buddhism, because if you look around the animal realm, there's lots of experiments with different kinds of forms that sentient beings can have, right? Different numbers of legs and different arrangements of eyes and all of these kinds of things. And yet, there's only one kind of form which is actually proven to be suitable for what we call intelligent life, right? And that's us. And there are good reasons for that, right? I mean, there's a good reasons why we have a large head on the top of our body, right? And why we have our senses arranged in these ways and why we're bipedal and so on and so forth. So actually, if you look closely at it, I think it is most likely that if we meet aliens, that they're going to be shaped something like us, not too different. But maybe I'm wrong. However they're shaped, though, and however we encounter them, without a doubt, we will experience them as other. Right? And this is something that we're still struggling greatly with in our society. We see in Australia today, they're struggling with the idea of asylum seekers. Right? The other. They have a different religion, a different skin colour, a different political background. Right? And so we feel that kind of suspicion, that hatred against them. And of course, simple historical fact, any historian will tell you that if you look back in Australia's history, back for the last 100 years, that every wave of immigrants into our country has faced exactly the same kind of scrutiny and exactly the same kind of criticisms. Right? Many of the people in the room today come from an Asian background. Now, probably you won't remember this, most of you, but I grew up in Perth in the 1980s, and around 1984, 85 in Perth, there was a very, very widespread and prominent campaign of posters that they put around Asians out or racial war. And I don't know if anybody remembers that. But that was, I see a few people nodding. Yeah? There was this Dutch neo-Nazi guy called Jack van Tongeren and a group of skinheads who he employed to put these things around the place. Asians out or racial war. Thousands of posters everywhere you went in Perth for a long time. And then they spread out. They started franchising and putting this stuff around. And they didn't just posters. They actually ended up firebombing, I think, a Vietnamese restaurant, you know. And this is happening in Perth, yeah, in not very long ago, in the mid-80s. So every community, when they come here, will face the same kinds of things, same kind of criticism and the same kinds of scrutiny and the same kind of unfair prejudice. That's how humans are. It's not very nice, but that tends to be how we are. So when we come from a Buddhist point of view, we try to get over that alienating. Right? We try to see people are more or less like us. And actually, this is the reality. If we go around the world, you know, you see people, yes, people have a different religion. They have a different culture. They have a different language. But at the end of the day, they're pretty much like us. Most people just want to live a peaceful life. Most people just want to be with their families. Most people just want to have enough to live on and a decent house and food to put on the table. Most people want to be able to live their lives and have fun and practice their religion and so on without being persecuted or harassed by others. And most of the times the things that people want are pretty simple and fairly reasonable. So this is why it's really important for us, if we're interested in our spiritual growth and emotional growth, to make this something which is very meaningful, okay? And to ask ourselves those hard questions, right? We can look in Buddhism, we can sit there and say, Sabbe satta bhavantu sukhitata. May all beings be happy, yeah? Oh, yeah, except for that being. I remember years ago, I was trying to teach loving kindness, and somebody said, oh, you know, Bhante, I just can't. How do I do loving kindness for John Howard? Oh, that was those days. These days, he doesn't look too bad, does he? So it's probably not so hard. I shouldn't say these things, sorry. Okay, moving on. So this is the difference, you know. We've just been on retreat in the monastery, and it's one of the things which is really wonderful about doing a retreat, you know. In the last 2 weeks of the retreat, so we spend like 3 months where we're just staying in the monastery and practicing and so on, but in that 3 months we also spend 2 weeks when we're just in our room and just meditating. So my personal retreat was the last 2 weeks. And so that was very nice. And it's one of the things that really struck me was about how much easier it was to do loving kindness for people when they're not there. Ah, may you all be happy. Ah, I'm so good at letting go. It's so blissful. Ah. Right? So we can have this idea, we can have it, oh, may all these aliens be happy. Yeah, we can think, oh, that'd be cool, you know, if there's different aliens, that'd be nice, may they be happy. But what happens when they actually show up, right? We've got asylum seekers from outer space. And of course you can see in the kind of popular imagination how these things play out, you know, when people make movies and science fiction books and things like that, then usually the story of an alien encounter is a violent one, right? It's the story of hatred and invasion and destruction. Not always, but that's usually how it goes. But the likelihood is that when we find, you know, when we contact beings in outer space, the likelihood is that they'll be kind of pretty much like us. They probably want to live happy lives. They probably are, you know, attached to their families and so on. They've probably got a curiosity to them. I mean, I don't think they'd develop an advanced technology unless they had some curiosity. So they've probably got a sense of wonder. They've probably got a sense of wanting to know things and understand things. And all of those qualities are things that we could find a sense of connection for if we wanted to, and that we could share together if we wanted to, or we could just blow each other up if we wanted to. That's the other option, right? So we're practicing loving kindness meditation, right? Who are we doing loving kindness for? Do loving kindness for ourselves. No, it's a starting place. Sometimes that seems a bit hard, doesn't it? Maybe you can do loving kindness for all beings except for yourself. And sometimes we like to, we tend to avoid, and we tend to project outwards. But in our spiritual practice, we have to keep turning inwards. You know, you think about this person in here. Who am I? What kind of value do I have? What kind of worth do I have as a person? And so from a Buddhist point of view, you don't have worth as a person because somebody else gives it to you. Right? Not because of social status. Not because of some degree that you've got. Not because of some job that you've got. You don't have worth because you're popular or that you're rich. And not even if you think of spiritual things. You know, you're not worthwhile because you're ordained as a monk or because God loves you or because you've got an eternal soul or any of those kinds of things. All of those things are irrelevant. Yeah. The only thing that matters at the end of the day is that we feel. And this is what's really at the heart of the Buddha's teachings. Idam dukkham pajanati. One understands this is suffering. So moral worth of beings, of sentient beings, come from their capacity to suffer. And that capacity to suffer is what leads ultimately to wisdom. So don't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid to suffer. Suffering's all right. It's okay. I'm suffering right now. It's all right. I've got a sore neck. I don't know why it's sore, but it just is. It's annoying, but that's okay. It's just suffering. So we shouldn't be practicing Buddhism or practicing the Dhamma in order to escape from suffering. It's what people think. I think, oh, I'm going to, you know, Buddha said we shouldn't have any attachments and we should get rid of suffering. Buddha didn't say anything about the sort. Listen to what he actually said in the first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Dukkhang parinyeyanti me. Yeah, that suffering is to be fully known. Fully known, parinyeya. Yeah? To know all in every possible respect. Right? That's a Buddhist practice, is to understand suffering in every way. Not to avoid it and escape it and get rid of it. Yeah? And the understanding that, and it doesn't mean, you know, we think of this idea that Buddhism said we should get rid of attachments and so on. Yes, but specifically, it's that kind of craving which creates suffering. This is what the Buddha said we should get rid of. We should let go of. Right? Pahatabang, we should let go of. Craving that gives rise to suffering. And so it doesn't mean every kind of craving. If you want a glass of water, then have a glass of water. It's not leading to suffering. Right, that's just having a glass of water. So you have to investigate. Ask yourself, what are those kinds of craving and attachment that are actually leading to suffering? Right, and you start there. And so usually, what happens is that we just ignore that. Right, we get this idea in our head about what we're attached to or what we're craving or something like that, and we want to try to let go of or something, but we don't understand what really is. That's giving rise to suffering. Okay? And so the thing that I'm trying to point to through this talk this evening, this is one of those main things which gives rise to suffering, and that's that tendency of alienation, of alienating ourselves and alienating others. Why is it that we feel lost? Why is it that we feel like we're floating in the middle of the intergalactic space? You know, meaning, like a meaningless speck of nothing in the universe. Right? Why is it that we feel like that? Right? It's because we've alienated others. because we have gone through our lives cutting ourselves off, being afraid to feel, being afraid to make connections. Yeah? And we've been cutting ourselves off. And the end result of that is that we feel alienated, we feel lost and alone. I remember one time, these things sometimes they sneak up on you, you don't notice them. And I remember one time I was in Thailand, and it was just a little kind of thing. It wasn't any big deal, but one time I was staying in a hut in the north of Thailand in the forest in the province of Nan. And I lived there in a little hut in the forest for a year by myself. And, you know, you stay in a place for a long time, you get kind of very relaxed and so on. And there was I remember one time that somebody came to visit me. Hardly anybody came to that place, but very occasionally somebody came and we have a bit of a chat. And we were sitting outside, and underneath the eaves in the hut, there was a beehive, and the bees used to come around, and usually in those places it's very hot and you're sweating, and they sort of land on you and will drink your sweat. And I got so used to this that I just kind of sit there and the bees would be drinking my sweat. And these people came to visit me, and they're looking at me with kind of horror, you know, and the the bees are coming, and they're like, ah! Like that. It never occurred to me that there'd be anything wrong or anything to be afraid of. It never even crossed my mind. It was just part of being there in the forest. These little creatures come. And so you cut yourself off from these things. Yeah? You alienate them. You're alienated from nature. You're alienated from animals, from insects, from beings, from creatures all around. We cut ourselves off. We define ourselves as separate from, as better than, right? As different, as other. We define ourselves, we're cutting ourselves off. And then, oh, I'm lonely. Why am I lonely? Why is life so hard? Why doesn't anybody love me? Yeah. So when we could look at it from a Dharma point of view, from a Buddhist point of view, nobody to blame, right? Nobody's done that to you. Right? It's the choices that we make. So every time we cut somebody off, every time we think of somebody as other, right? And every time we do that, we're diminishing our own humanity. We're diminishing our own consciousness. Right? And as our society goes on, it seems that in some ways, it seems that we're getting better at this, right? I mean, for example, we don't endorse racism anymore, right? So we don't think, oh, because somebody has a different skin color, that therefore they're other and they're lesser. Right? That's not to say that there isn't still racism in our world, but it's not accepted. It's not normal, right? It's something even if people are racist, they'll try to deny it or pretend that they're not. It's the same with sexism, right? Again, we sort of moved on from thinking that you know, women are different, other, lesser. Right? And this is a very common thread throughout most human cultures throughout history. And we're moving to a point where we don't have to think like that anymore. People with different kinds of sexuality, gay people, lesbians, trans, and so on. There's been a huge shift in the world in the last 10 years. You know, if you look at the figures on the acceptance of same-sex marriage, there's been a massive shift in a lot of countries. And that's a thing of acceptance, of saying, actually, people are people. Well, their sexuality is not, who cares? It's one of the most embarrassing things about religion, honestly, the fact that people in religion seem to be so obsessed on what other people are doing in their bedrooms. God. Who cares? Right? That's not what religion's about. That's not what spirituality is about. Spirituality is about learning to love each other and to be respectful and to help each other and to support each other. not to condemn somebody because they're different. It's ridiculous. Yeah, so that there is, I think there is a progress there. I'm actually quite optimistic in that way. I think we have been getting better as a human culture, as a global culture, in some respects. And we are, I think, starting to, you know, we're starting to move even to animal rights, right? And I was involved in Perth during the mid-80s in the animal liberation movement. And, you know, even though obviously there's a long way to go, but I've seen some really good changes since that time. You know, when we first started, you know, you couldn't, you know, there's very little, you couldn't get any vegetarian food around the place and these kinds of things. So, and now these things are much more common. So I think that, and you're even having movements. There was a court case in the US last year where they tried to establish a legal precedent that a chimpanzee could be a person. Right? And so therefore, you know, you couldn't do experiments on them and so on. And I can't remember the details of it. Somebody here might know more about it than I do, but I think they lost the court case, but it was something which certainly is moving in that direction, recognizing the rights of animals. So this is all part of that growth of consciousness, right? That extension of our loving kindness, of being mindful. Right? So being mindful is not just about being aware of your own body and mind and your own mind states and things like that, but it's also about consciously developing those mind states in that positive way, to consciously aspire to that ideal of sabbe satta, to keep on asking yourself, you know, is this the best that I can be? Is this really, you know, when these attitudes come up, the anger and the hatred come up, and you think, could I be better? Could I love more? Could I be more accepting? And what you find when you do that is you find that most of the time that has an incredibly transformative effect. Right? It doesn't work every time, right? Because, well, the world's pretty messed up and sometimes bad things happen. So you can't expect it to work every time, but most of the time, if you take that as your attitude and say, I'm not going to react, I'm not going to respond, I'm not going to get angry, but I'm just going to accept. I'm going to say, my duty is to love, to ask, how can I love more? How can I accept more? But one thing that is important to reflect on when you're doing that and to acknowledge is, to what extent am I doing this in order to genuinely help someone, and to what extent am I doing this in order to just feel better about myself? Right? So sometimes that's also what we can do. And if you're somebody who's been a parent and you brought up children, then you know that sometimes you have to have tough love. Sometimes you have to lay down rules, and sometimes you have to put punishments and things like that to get people to stop doing things that are harmful. And that happens with kids, it happens with monks in a monastery. Ah, you should hear some of the things that the monks get up to in the monastery. I'm only kidding, mostly. But, even in the monastery when we have to do these things, and sometimes you have to be firm with people. You know, loving someone doesn't just mean giving them, being Mr. Nice Guy and giving them everything that they want all the time. You know, sometimes you have to make rules, and sometimes you have to make boundaries, and sometimes you have to be firm about things, right? But there's a difference for being firm and for being punishing, right? So you need to have a clarity and a consistency in how you do things, but not the idea of punishing. The idea of punishing is really kind of alien to a Buddhist way of thinking. So I would really like it if when we did, imagine that we did make contact with aliens, what would happen? Would everyone go, yay, we finally found some brothers and sisters across the galaxy. We're not alone. Hello, friends. Or would they be full of fear and suspicion? What would the other guys be like? Right? I mean, I would like to think that you know, we would have some wisdom. That we would recognize the possibility that making contact with others can be incredibly beneficial. You know, you think about that in terms of our global society today. You know, we have the different cultures that our society is made up of, the European culture and the Asian culture and different places. And these days, all those different cultures kind of meet and mingle. And, you know, we learn so much from each other. You know, I wouldn't have become a Buddhist monk if those Asian people hadn't come to Perth in the 1980s. We wouldn't have a Buddhist society. We wouldn't be here today. And if that hate-filled message of Van Tongeren, if that had won the day, none of us would be here. So those victories that we win through loving kindness, and so the Buddha said, is the greatest kind of victory. Yeah, much better than a man who kills 1,000 enemies on the battlefield is somebody who can win, be victor over themselves. So if we're able to overcome our own greed, hatred, and delusion, if we're able to overcome that limiting of the heart that stops us from being able to love aliens or crickets or cockroaches or what else is there? Supporters of the wrong football code, I guess. And so if we can't overcome those things, then we'll never progress in our spiritual practice. So to keep reflecting, keep asking those questions. What more can I be? How more can I love? How more can I let go? How more can I be accepting? This is what we call bhavana, is meditation. That's what real meditation is. Chitta bhavana is making your heart bigger. It's funny that we have this idea in meditation, though. You listen to the way people talk about meditation, and so many people say meditation is about focusing. It's about concentrating. It's about being one-pointed. All of these kind of words that are really hard and narrow. And they're all either things you don't find in the Buddhist scriptures at all, or things which are badly translated and misconstrued. Look at how the Buddha described meditation. Jetasa vipulena mahagatena appamanena. With a heart that is vast, abundant, measureless. Right? The Buddha said, make your heart like the great ocean. Make your heart as vast as the sky. Right? That's how the Buddha said to meditate. Yeah, make your heart as broad as this great earth. Yeah, not make your mind focused and concentrated in things. And make your mind, your heart as vast as the sky. To be able to accept everything. And then when the aliens come, we'll be like, oh, hi, how are you going? All right, so that's my talk on loving kindness, mindfulness, and aliens for you this evening. And questions, I guess? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you so much. Okay, so a question from Budhi from Sri Lanka. Hello, Budhi, how are you? And the question is, in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, at one point it says, Majjhima Rasaka Anukatula. What does Anuka mean? Did the Buddha mean microscopic organisms? So just to give a bit of background here, one of the Buddha's discourses, a very famous, very popular one, is the discourse on loving kindness. And it's one that we recite very regularly in different ceremonies and so on. And, of course, very beautiful discourse. And one of the things that makes very clearly that point I was trying to get across during the talk tonight about that loving kindness is for all different kinds of beings. And it actually kind of goes through and lists different kinds of beings that there are in very general terms, right? So middle-sized beings, small beings, anukka and tula, tula meaning sort of gross or large, and anukka, word anu, literally meaning something like an atom. Okay, so when when the Indian philosophers talked about an atom, they would use the word anu or paramanu, and so anukka means, yes, exactly, literally microscopic organisms. It's difficult to say, like I said before, it's difficult to say exactly how small a being has to be before it's sentient. In the suttas, it doesn't really discuss this. And in the monk's Vinaya, or monastic Vinaya, it says that a monk shouldn't kill any living being, even one as small as a bed bug. Right? So basically, anything which is visible, that you shouldn't kill. Right? So that's obviously kind of a pragmatic thing, right? You couldn't live if you were afraid of killing invisible beings all the time, right? So that doesn't really answer the question so much. So yes, I think anukka does mean certainly very small organisms, whether it means microscopic organisms or not. Another interesting thing about in Buddhism is that if you read in some of the Buddhist texts like the Visuddhimagga and so on, it talks about how in our bellies and so on, there live all of these countless different kinds of worms and microscopic creatures and so on. And interesting, if you look at the biology, there were some interesting articles in the last year or so that pointed out that actually we have more non-human DNA in our bodies than we have human DNA, right? Because of all the bacteria and worms and all the things that live in us, there's actually a greater quantity of non-human DNA inside each of us than there is human DNA, yeah? So we're all aliens already, yeah? Interesting that, isn't it? You know, we think of ourselves as human, but most of our DNA actually isn't human DNA. So obviously in those days they were aware of these, that there were all these microscopic organisms and these little creatures, and that they lived inside us. Okay, so Pierre from Germany. Hello, Pierre, how are you going? How to handle insects and animals that might hurt you? For example, what if you're being bitten by mosquitoes, especially when you're meditating? Come on, you've got plenty of blood left, haven't you? They just want a little bit. It's just they take such a little bit of blood. Are you really going to begrudge them that? You know, one time I was on retreat in Malaysia. I spent a rains retreat in a kuti in a hut in Malaysia, and that was a very interesting sort of setup. If any of you know the Malaysian city of Ipoh, it's kind of surrounded by these very kind of sheer mountains or hills, and they're made of marble, and they kind of crack, and then you can sort of go inside them, and then we built a hut inside the middle of this hill, so you had to sort of go through this little tunnel to get through there, and then it kind of opened up inside the hills, kind of like Lost World or something, and we sort of climbed in there and built this little hut. And I spent the rains retreat in there, and I told the people, you know, I'd been there for like a year or something, and I said, look, you know, we've been there this year, we've given lots of teachings and so on, and so, you know, I'd really like it if you could just give me the time to be on retreat, and I'd just spend this 3 months doing my meditation. And the people in that center were very kind, so they agreed to that. One of the people who was helping there, many of you know, Ayahasapanya from Dhammasara Monastery, and she and her family were some of my main supporters in those days. So I spent 3 months basically staying inside this hill and meditating in this little hut. And I'd collect water from the roof of the hut and keep a little water tank there. Normally, we put filters on them to stop there from being mosquito larvae growing in there. But one time, for some reason, it didn't work, and I had these mosquito larvae in this bucket, right? And so I was really annoyed. What am I going to do now? Oh, you know, I either have to take my bucket and then I have to go down, because there wasn't any puddles or anything, right? You're in the middle of a kind of up a mountain. There's no way you can, no streams or anything to put them, right? So I have to go down and then I have to go and find a stream or a pond and tip these out, or what am I going to do to them? I can't kill them. So anyway, I thought, I'll just leave it. I'll just put it off till tomorrow, right? And anyway, so the next day I came out and didn't do anything, and they seemed quite happy, so I just kind of left them there. And then after a couple of days, I'd never kind of watched this before, but you know, normally if you have mosquito larvae or something, normally you tip them out or you get rid of them, so you don't actually see. But I'd come out every day and you could see they're actually growing and changing every day, and I'd come out and they'd get kind of darker and they sort of become a little bit more mosquito-like. And I got kind of really interested. I got quite fascinating, and so I'd come out every day and look at them. And they're becoming less like larvae and more like mosquitoes, until one day they were gone and there was only one left, and that one was standing on the surface of the water, right, just ready to fly away. And I was like, oh, my little babies. You've been born. And this little mosquito was there, and I was like, oh, come to daddy. Come on, come on. You want some blood? Come on, here you go. And then he flew off and flew off into the distance. Oh, that's so sweet. So mosquitoes are okay. So if you're sitting meditation and you put on some mosquito repellent or whatever, but just understand the mosquito is just doing what it does. It doesn't not trying to harm you or anything like that. It just wants to eat. So if you can be patient and let the mosquito have something to eat, that's good. If you think that there might be some malaria or dengue or something, then that's different. So, but you know, you don't need to kill it. But usually, just using a mosquito net or something is good enough. You know, the monks and the nuns and the meditators in Thailand and Sri Lanka and places where there's lots of mosquitoes all the time, and they don't need to kill. They just use a mosquito net and some repellent or whatever, and you get by fine. Okay, so that's, I think, all for this evening. Are there any more announcements, Cecilia? Are those announcements done? Okay, so maybe we can finish up by paying respects to the Triple Gem.